At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Kiwi Talks. My guest today is a wizard programmer who is probably best known for bringing Dragon's Lair to the Amiga, Doom to the SNES, as well as being behind the PlayStation emulator Bleem. I'm convinced he has a superpower that he's not telling anyone. I'd like to welcome Randy Linden. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Thank you very much. That's a nice introduction.
Well, people do wonder, you know, you do have an extensive skill set there.
Yes. Well, I've been doing this now for 40 years. So that's a long time. I got my start when I was very young. When I was 13, I had my first program professionally published. I was lucky because my mom got us a Commodore 64. And at school, we had a Commodore PET computer. And they were both 6502 based. And so I was able to take what I learned at school. There was no official computer class at school. It was all self-taught. But I was able to take that home and practice at home and write a Centipede clone when I was 13 on the Commodore 64. And that's how I got my start. And I really liked it. I was lucky to have found my calling so early on in life. And I've been doing it ever since.
You're lucky because most people don't know what they want to do at that age.
Yeah, I didn't know that it was what I wanted to do as a career. I just knew that I really enjoyed doing it and stuck
and
with it.
Here you are.
And here I am. Yeah.
Yeah.
40 years later.
Exactly. So that's awesome. Just to switch things up a little bit, because I know you've talked about Doom extensively, but I thought it's a bit of an icebreaker, and we have talked about this off air a little bit, but your experience with Zelda Breath of the Wild, right? Because
yes.
you don't get to play video games much these days, and yet you've put 120 plus hours into it over the last few months.
Yes.
But just your overall experience with it and how you felt about it from a programming standpoint, and whether you were able to separate the two or whether you were looking at things and trying to figure it out.
Both. Both. Zelda is as I've described Nintendo games, and Nintendo really seems to nail this. Their games are like an onion, where you peel back one layer, and there's another layer, and another layer, and another layer, and you just wonder how much deeper you can go, and yet it just keeps on going. And I was both immersed in Zelda. I originally got it because Tears of the Kingdom was coming out, and all of my friends at work said, you've got to play Breath of the Wild. It's really, really good. And now my favorite game up to that point was Super Mario Odyssey, which beat out Super Mario World from the Super NES day. That was the last 2D platformer that I played. And so I got Breath of the Wild, and I got a really good deal and wasn't expecting it to be so all consuming of my spare time. And so in a matter of four months, I managed to rack up. I didn't even know that the Switch kept track of how long you played a particular title. And for comparison purposes, Super Mario Odyssey, I think it said that I had played between 20 and 30 hours.
Okay, that's a decent amount.
And Zelda was 120 hours. And I was marveling at what they were able to accomplish from a technical level with the shadows and the graphics and the texturing and the level of detail, even like the blades of grass. And so I was looking at it from a technical standpoint, but also found myself slipping away into the world of Breath of the Wild because it was just so well done. The physics engine that they've got and the interaction of the characters, and even some of the annoying side quests and shrine quests that you have to do. And by annoying, annoying because some of them require specific timing, time of day, right. And some of them require you to stealthily follow another character and see where they go. And after having played Zelda for 120 plus hours, I've still only completed one of the ancient beasts. There's three, and then there's Ganon at the end, and I've only completed the very first one. That should tell you how broad the game is. I got my money's worth without a shadow of a doubt.
Oh yeah, I think you would have got your money's worth after the first 30 hours.
Oh yeah, or less.
Everything now is just a bonus.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. And it still kept me engaged and amazed. And so, yeah, it's absolutely one of the most spectacular things I've ever seen on a computer.
Is there one particular standout moment or just one moment where you're like, how in the world did they pull this off?
I'm thinking that. Yes, there is. The very first time it starts to rain and the lightning strikes and the screen lights up and the vibration motors whir, and I jumped because it startled me so much. The quality of the graphics and their special effects that they really paid attention to, I would have to say that really stood out as something special. It scared me the very first time that I was in the lightning storm and wasn't expecting that. I was expecting, it starts to rain and you're thinking, okay, so they're going to make rain effects and it's going to be, a little smeary and it's going to be the standard fare that you've seen all the time. And then all of a sudden this lightning bolt strikes really close by and you can hear it and the reverberation and the vibration motors go off. And yeah, when you're playing in portable mode, it really surprised me.
Yeah. So with the programming aspect of it, were you just marveling all the time or were you able to disconnect yourself fully? Because sometimes game developers, because of what they do, they just look for all the things that are wrong or the things they would have improved on or just try and point out everything. So I'm just wondering, because it's rare for that to happen, right? Where someone could be fully disconnected from it and just be fully immersed in it without trying to work out, I suppose, how the sausage was made in this case.
Yeah. Yeah. I would sort of go between marveling at the graphics, wondering how they were made, coming up with ways in which to implement those graphics. Every so often I would notice there was a level of detail snap, off in the distance, something all of a sudden snaps between two different levels of detail. Yeah. And you could see the graphics change. It was really well hidden in Breath of the Wild. I was conversely, as much as it was my favorite game until Breath of the Wild, I was a little more, I don't want to say underwhelmed, but I wasn't as surprised and impressed with the level of graphics in Super Mario Odyssey as much as I was with Breath of the Wild. Especially the first level, I thought that the fog effects, where they had the rolling sort of fog and the valleys where you sort of run in between, the hills and there's valleys and there's fog and it rolls. You can sort of see the polygon edges there. And that doesn't really happen in Breath of the Wild. I don't know if they use the same engine or the same technology or what groups exist at Nintendo these days. But I was much more impressed all around with the level of graphics that were in Breath of the Wild, and stunned that it's running on a Switch. I mean, that's amazing.
So does that motivate you? You play a game like that and you get charged up, I suppose, and you're like, oh, I've got to up my game here as a programmer.
Yes, absolutely. That's like, oh, wow, they did something. Like I said, that was a perfect example with the lightning strike. It's like, wow, they really made excellent use of the platform. It does. It sort of makes me look back and remember a lot of the things that I have done, and could I have done it better? There's always better. It's always possible to do something better, especially when it comes to programming. And I am still impressed when people write their very first program, because it takes such a leap in the way that you think about things to be able to write any program. And I'm always impressed when people write their first programs. And it takes a lot for me to be surprised and delighted. But Breath of the Wild, really, this isn't a commercial for Breath of the Wild.
No, it's just gone this way. It's fine.
It just really, really, they really did everything so well that it serves as an excellent example of what happens when you spend a lot of time and you can really apply polish to that degree. It's very impressive.
Yeah. Something else that's also impressive is obviously your Doom SNES port.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
You have talked about it extensively, so I thought I'd try and tackle this from a couple of different angles or touch on nuances that maybe haven't been covered. One thing in particular was the rocket launcher in Doom SNES, right? It's buffed up more than the PC version. Yes. I'm wondering what caused that to happen. Was that intentional and an unintentional byproduct of something that you implemented or needed to change?
Both. It was intentional, but it was a side effect of not having access to any of the original id source data, resources, the engine, the technology was all developed completely independently. So everything that's in Doom for the SNES is based on observation of the PC version. Now sometimes I get the observations wrong, and one of them is the, well, there's two of them. One of them is the strength of the rocket launcher.
Yeah.
So the rocket launcher is more powerful in Doom for the SNES. And it works to, I think, that version's advantage, because the monsters, there's no infighting with the monsters.
They're more difficult. Yeah.
And they're more difficult because they sort of go straight towards you.
Yeah, they charge right at you every time.
Yes, exactly. And so the gameplay was reviewed by id Software. It was reviewed by Sculptured Software's QA team, but it was also reviewed by id Software, and they provided feedback. So it was tweaked and it was adjusted. Because they knew that it was an original engine and we couldn't just set the damage values to be exactly the same.
Yes.
Because there's no direct parallel like that. When you compare the two engines, that they produce similar visual results, but it's sort of like comparing apples and oranges. They're both fruits, but they're different fruits. Even though they're both sort of round and from a distance, they sort of look the same. For Doom for the SNES, there's a number of things that are born out of that reverse engineering how things work. One of them is the rocket launchers, and another one is the shotgun fires a blast that's effectively one big bullet rather than individual shells.
So did id Software just not notice it when they were, because they were playtesting it, I'm assuming, right?
Yes.
And they just didn't notice that the rocket launcher was more buff, or they just didn't care, or they thought it worked well for your version of the game?
I think it's the latter, that they felt that it worked well for the Super NES version of the game, especially with the difficulty being higher in the Super NES version. My recollection is that they thought that the weapons were balanced, and that the gameplay was a good approximation of the PC version.
So was monster infighting ever considered, or did you rule that out quite early on in the process when you were trying to optimize it?
That's a good question. Monster infighting was ruled out, not from a technical perspective, but because there are no rotations for the monsters. So the monsters always face you.
Yeah.
And that was done for space reasons. So the ROM size was the maximum that's supported by the SuperFX 2, which was 16 megabits or 2 megabytes. And there was no room in the ROM to store all the different directions of the rotations for the enemies, or even the objects. And so the monsters always face you. And if there was monster infighting, it would just look bizarre. The demons would, you know, throw fireballs, and they would be coming out of the side, and it would just look weird that two monsters that were facing you would be fighting against each other, especially off in the distance. So that was a non-technical limitation of the engine. It was a space limitation.
But you also had, so say in the PC version, imps can't hurt other imps. But in the SNES version, they can. Like, say if one's behind each other and it fires a fireball and it hits the one in front, it will damage it, right?
Yes.
So was that to try and offset the infighting?
No, that was a matter of, I think that was mostly a matter of if there's a projectile and it intersects with another object, that object is going to be damaged. And so it's one of those cases where, the PC version has this caveat that nobody brought up and nobody mentioned and nobody said, well, you're doing it wrong.
Hmm.
And so logically, I just thought, well, there's a projectile, and if it intersects with some other object, that object gets damaged. That makes sense from a realism perspective. And nobody said that the imp's damage shouldn't do damage to another imp.
Hmm.
So it does.
With nightmare mode, I mean, you must have ruled out pretty early the whole respawning monsters. I mean,
no,
really?
Yes. That was another, it's not a technical limitation, because the amount of time that the game spends, running the game logic is small compared to the amount of time that it spends drawing and rendering the display. So to add a little bit of extra logic to have the monsters respawn in Nightmare was, it's not a technical challenge to do so. It was just one of those, had no idea that's what happened in Nightmare mode. I just thought the difficulty was harder in Nightmare mode, but didn't realize that the monsters respawned. So that's why in Doom for the SNES, they don't do it, because nobody said, by the way, the monsters don't respawn, you're going to fix that, and I would have fixed it.
Oh, so you could have actually done it. Wow.
Yes.
That would have made the Nightmare mode even
even more difficult. Yeah.
Because if I recall correctly, in the PC version on Nightmare, the demons don't necessarily charge at you, right? They just fire projectiles just constantly. That's pretty much what they do. Whereas in the SNES version, they're already faster as it is. And then on Nightmare, it's kicked it up a notch. So even enemies like the Barons of Hell are super fast, right? On Nightmare, they just charge right at you. So if they could charge right at you and the respawn thing,
it would
make
it very difficult. The logic is very, very simple. It basically looks at the position of the two, you and compared to the monster, and it knows how to move towards you following the shortest path, and that's what it does. That's all it does. It's very, very simple logic. And that same movement logic is applied to all of the monsters. The monsters don't have separate custom logic for each of the monsters. So that's why the Barons of Hell charge straight at you, just like all the other monsters. They just charge straight at you.
Yeah, and it's scary.
Yeah.
I remember it being super scary when I was just a youngin' playing it. I was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Well, on the Super NES back in 1995.
Yeah, 95 is when it released. Yeah.
Yeah, 1995. The average person didn't have a $2,000 PC to run Doom. And so if you didn't have a PC, you had a gaming platform. And if you had one of the gaming platforms, you either had a Genesis or Mega Drive, or you had a Super NES. And so the Super NES version, it was one of the few more realistic, more violent games out there at the time. There was that. There was Mortal Kombat, for example. There was a handful of games that were more explicit.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, obviously, you were guessing everything when you were porting it, right? So,
what about the stuff? Total guesswork.
Yeah, but some of the stuff you actually can't see, right? Like, you can't see the AI of the monsters.
Right. So on the SNES version, they're a lot more stupid. They are, the SNES version. Like I said, the monsters basically don't have the same level of intelligence as they do on the PC version. And they just try and find the shortest path to get to you. They fire at you if they're a certain distance away. Otherwise, they use their hand-to-hand, their melee combat.
Is that something you could have fixed if you had more time?
Yes.
Time thing.
It was a time thing. There was tremendous pressure to get the program done in time for the holiday season. Back then, if you weren't in time for Thanksgiving weekend, let me back up a bit. Thanksgiving weekend, Black Friday, as it's known, was the beginning of the big sales season for video games in particular. But back then, there was no such thing as digital downloads. Not really. There were if you were looking at PC games, but not for cartridges that had to be physically manufactured. So there was a huge amount of lead time for the cartridges because they had to pass Nintendo's quality assurance and certification, and then they had to be manufactured. And the cartridges were for Doom for the Super NES. It was one of the first games to use the Super FX 2. So it had the custom chip on it. It had a ROM chip, and the ROM chip was custom silicon. It's just a ROM chip. Don't get me wrong. It's nothing fancy, but it's still had to be manufactured, and they had to place an order, that they being Williams, or I think it was Imagineer and Ocean were the other partners.
Yeah, that's correct. Yes.
So they had to place their order for the manufacture of the cartridges, and the cartridges then arrived by boat, or, well, huge ship, I think. Yeah. So there was this huge amount of lead time. And I only presented, I vaguely recall presenting the game to Sculptured 6 or 8 months before we wrapped and we finalized things. So there was a lot of pressure.
So how do you deal with that as a programmer that needs to be in the zone at all times? I mean, I'm not sure if you're doing intense crunch or if you're doing overnighters to try and pull this off. I'm not sure if that
both.
Was the case. Right.
Both.
So,
yeah.
So,
yeah. Both.
So how do you function? Because it is at a certain point, if you're not getting enough sleep or you're not getting enough rest, I'm sure the computer screen starts to look like there's dots on it, right? And
it
everything
does.
Would kind of just blur.
Mm-hmm. It does. And what I find is I find that I can tell when I'm in the zone and just keep going and pushing. And I can also tell when I can't think clearly.
Right.
And at that point, I sort of take a step back and stop for a little while, take a pause, get some sleep, eat something, take a walk. But especially when I'm in the zone, I don't like to interrupt what I view as not so much a technical process, but a very creative process. A lot of the projects that I've worked on, while they're technically impressive, they solve things in a very creative way. I view programming as a really nice melding of technical and creative aspects. And when you're in the zone, you're able to accomplish so much more. I usually try and, if I'm in the zone, recognize it and stay in the zone for as long as I can. But yeah, there was a lot of crunch. There was a lot of very, very late nights and overnights. Partially because I guess I could say this now, the financial arrangements for my royalties were adjusted. Right. For every week I was late, I got 1% less. And I will say I was 2 weeks late. Yeah, I was 2 weeks late. So I got 2% less than I would have received. And I can't say the total that I received.
Of course. Yeah.
But yes, it was an unusual arrangement because there was the uniqueness of the product, the unique ability I had bringing it to Sculptured Software to deliver the product, but there was the challenge of the deadline and the time frame. And so we came to an agreement whereby for every week that I overran, as I said, we agreed to deduct 1% off of my royalty rate. That served as an incentive.
Okay. But that still must be hard, though, because you've got to try and manage your time effectively, but you can't determine when you're going to be in the zone and when you're not going to be in the zone, right?
True. That's where the I guess, let's see here. I guess that was only... How many years programming was that? 3 to 95. So I guess that would have been, I'd been a programmer for 12, 13 years at that point.
Which is a long time already.
Yeah. In this field, that's a lot of experience.
Yes.
I am pretty good at estimating my time, what I can accomplish. And I would say I back that up with hours. If my estimate is off, I willingly put in the extra hours to meet the deadlines.
Yes.
Rather than just blow past the deadlines. That I generally don't do. And because of the, there was such an importance on hitting the release dates for Doom for the Super NES, partially because of the advertising budget. They did a commercial, a TV commercial, for Doom. Wow. For the Super NES. And there was lots and lots of money and budget going into the advertising. So if we were late and we missed our ship date, not only would it cost us in terms of sales because we missed Black Friday, but they had a special, I forget exactly what the date was, but they called it Doomsday.
Right.
When they were launching and they had TV commercials and, oh yeah, it was a big deal. So
I suppose your reputation is tied to it as well, right? So
yes.
If you don't meet your deadline, then that it almost is like Chinese whispers, I suppose, and that gets around that Randy didn't meet his deadline. So there's
exactly.
That pressure as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of pressure. And there's a self-imposed pressure as well.
Yes. I think that's quite common with creatives.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
To sort of push what was technically possible, what was graphically possible, what was achievable, and do it in a short time frame. I don't know many programmers that say, I'm going to do the absolute most average that I possibly can and just, you know, programmers I know say, oh, I want to do so much more. And are limited by the time frame. The most important, I would have to say, one of the most important things ever, as far as being a programmer is concerned, is to ship. It is incredibly difficult to actually ship product. And especially when you've got a hard deadline, like we did with Doom, shipping was, you know, the features would be cut in order to ship. One of the features that was cut was the X-Band support. The X-Band support was only partially implemented in the actual cartridges. So I spent the following couple of months with people from Catapult Entertainment working on the X-Band support after the cartridges had already shipped. And you're probably thinking, well, wait a second, the cartridge was ROM. How did that work? It worked because I had saved the version of the software at the particular build that was shipped on the ROM. And the Catapult X-Band hardware was sort of like a super duper Game Genie. Remember the Game Genie?
Yeah,
where
that's right. With all
you
the
could
cheat
type
codes.
In the codes. Right,
yeah.
All the cheat codes. And all it basically did was it watched the address bus. Let me put this really simply. It changed memory. It had the ability to change memory on a temporary basis.
Yeah.
So the ROM could be patched with RAM that was in the Catapult X-Band hardware. And so it took a couple of months working to get the multiplayer finished because I had left little patch points throughout the ROM. So they were waiting to be used, but it took that much longer. I would have liked to have shipped with the X-Band support built in, but there just wasn't time.
So you have you're known in the industry as being a lightning quick programmer, but I suppose, how do you balance the whole quality versus quantity thing, right? Because if you're doing stuff very quickly, then usually the quality gets compromised. Usually. Sometimes you can get that balance right. And you're obviously very good at that. But I'm wondering if you've always had that ability, or is that something that's a craft you really had to hone and really, really pinpoint and get down?
You're right. You're exactly right on that. It took years. I think that one of the most important skills to have as a programmer is discipline. The ability to sort of buckle down and focus and sort of know your end goal. I used to like saying that I could look at the big picture and I could also see all the small details. And that's true, but it requires a huge amount of discipline to be able to break things apart into small enough manageable pieces so that you can program them. And practice, I think, is the flip side of discipline, or the complementary aspect of discipline. It took a lot of practice to be able to write code quickly and lots of it and get it right. I generally speaking don't have many bugs in my code, but that's because as I'm writing my code, I'm also testing it. I don't sort of put together a whole bunch of code and just send it off to testing and hope things work. I test what I've written to make sure it does what I think it's supposed to be doing. And of course, everybody has bugs. I'm not saying that my code doesn't have bugs. But usually the bugs that I've written are either something really stupid that it's like, oops, you really should have, tightened things up a little bit there, or it's something really, really complicated. One of the most difficult bugs that I had to track down was actually in Bleemcast, and it was with Metal Gear Solid, and there was a tester who was able to play the game and get it to lock up on the Dreamcast. And I couldn't reproduce it. Nobody else could reproduce it, but give the game to this particular player, and even doing the same things that he was doing, couldn't reproduce it, but he was able to do it 100% of the time. And I spent, I want to say, 3 days debugging this one particular bug. And it turns out that it was a hardware bug in the PowerVR chipset. There was a particular combination of polygons that were being rendered by the tile accelerator, which basically takes a given polygon and it splits it up into 32 by 32 pixel tiles.
Right.
So they only have to deal with one 32 by 32 pixel tile at a time. And if an edge of a polygon ever so slightly happens to be inside a tile, but skirt right along the edge, and you're using a particular mode of this PowerVR hardware, the tile accelerator gets confused and the graphics chip locks up. And you're probably thinking, why didn't other games on the Dreamcast ever just hang for no particular reason? And I was wondering the same thing myself. And I thought, this can't possibly be that Metal Gear Solid on Dreamcast is the only game that's exhibiting this. And so I reverse engineered some of the Sega libraries. And it turns out that they detect this particular situation where the graphics hardware has locked up. And if the graphics hardware is not responding, they reset the graphics hardware. So it was a known issue, but not to me. So that's an example of a bug that you would sort of not expect to have to deal with, But isn't you get it, good at debugging.
Yeah, but also isn't it a case of like trying to find a needle in a haystack when you're trying to yes. find this one little issue, right?
Yes.
And you have to go through it all.
Yeah. Is I have to like, break down the scene.
Is that one of the most monotonous things that you have yes. to do? Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Very, very, very monotonous. Because I knew that the graphics hardware was seizing. It was failing to respond. It was failing to accept new input. So I knew it had something to do with the graphics, but couldn't for the life of me figure out what I was doing wrong. Looking at the hardware specs and the here's how things are supposed to operate, and you do this and this and this, and this is supposed to happen. And so I did this and this and this, and nothing. Graphics hardware is just not responding. But it was a case of didn't have a choice. It was sort of like the same thing with Doom for the Super NES. Didn't have a choice in whether or not I was going to be late. I had to be on time. And in this case, with Bleem for Dreamcast, didn't have a choice. The bug had to be tracked down and the bug had to be fixed. So I set out polygon by polygon, finding out exactly what data was being sent down to the graphics hardware. And that's when I realized, oh, there's this particular polygon that it, what it turned out to be was the guy moved his player in a particular way so that the angle of the camera got a scene. And we're talking about a full 3D scene here.
Wow.
So the one polygon just happened to skirt the very edge of in one tile, but out of another tile. And that happened to trigger the problem.
That's crazy. One little thing can cause yeah. a cascade of problems. Yes.
And it would manifest itself in the game locking up.
Yeah.
And it took hours and hours and hours to debug what was going on to discover that it was the graphics hardware. Because when a game freezes, the first thing you think of, oh, something's gone wrong with the dynamic recompiler, or something's gone wrong where it's not accepting input from the joystick anymore, or it took me a while to identify and isolate, because the screen wasn't corrupted. It was just frozen. And everything was still running in the background. It's just that it wasn't able to send down new polygon lists to the tile accelerator, because the tile accelerator had gotten stuck.
Hmm. Something that I don't think I've ever heard programmers actually ever discuss, but in terms of like what you eat, your diet, right? Because oh. that can contribute to brain fog, I suppose. Like if you overeat, then you feel lethargic yes. and you can't work. So are you yes. very cautious about what you eat, or when you don't eat, or you time everything? Like if you're in the zone, you don't eat at all, or there's yes. certain foods that you avoid to prevent yourself from getting any type of brain fog?
Not really. I have a terrible diet. I have sweet teeth. I love sweets.
You got a good set of teeth though.
Well, thank you. I like sweets. I used to drink Coca-Cola regular, not the diet stuff, because as it turns out, I'm allergic to the artificial sweeteners.
Ah, right.
So I just, okay. Yeah, so I just drank regular Coca-Cola, lots and lots and lots of it. But there isn't a particular diet that I adhere to. But when I'm in the zone, I don't think about time. I don't think about eating. I don't think about sleeping.
You can't. Yeah.
I can't. It just doesn't even...
Well, you can't risk losing it as well, right? You're in that
well,
zone.
That's the problem.
And you don't know exactly when you're going to be in that you don't know when you're going to be in that zone again, right? So yes. It's like finding the Holy Grail in a way. So you have to.
It is. It really is. Everything sort of makes perfect sense. Everything sort of clicks. All the pieces fit together perfectly. And I've found that with practice, the more you practice, the more frequently you end up in the zone. I think it's probably something similar to what professional athletes experience when they're in the zone and they can't miss a free throw.
Yeah.
When it comes to programming, they say, practice makes perfect. A lot of practice really does increase the frequency with which I find myself being in the zone and able to knock out a lot of code, even stuff that's tedious or stuff that's not interesting, stuff that's more boring. I find that my brain just starts clicking on its own and things just sort of come together really well.
Right. So what do you focus on first in terms of programming? Like say with Doom SNES, right? Is optimization like right at the top? That's what you focus on first? Or are you more about getting your hands dirty and just getting in the midst of it and then trying to work it out from there? Like, do you have a structured template that you follow, or is it kind of a case-by-case basis?
It really is a case-by-case basis. With Doom for the Super NES, the first task was to render the graphics. Well, let me back up. That's the second task. The first task was to understand the data formats, because I had the PC version. And there was the unofficial Doom specs, which sort of broke apart the WAD file. And here's how all the data pieces from the WAD file are assembled together into, one large package. So the first step was finding that information, using that information, and I've often said that we stand on the shoulders of giants. We absolutely do.
Mm.
Everything that I do has been based on all the experts and all the innovators and entrepreneurs that have come before me that have made it possible for me to do the kind of things that I do. So I used the Doom specs. I wrote a tool that broke apart the WAD file into all the individual components. And then I set about writing a rendering engine. And this is the same process that I used when I wrote the Quake for Game Boy Advance.
Yeah, which I was going to touch on. Yeah. We can go into that later, yeah.
was to write the rendering technology. For Doom for the Super NES, I wanted to make sure it was feasible. My gut instinct, I don't usually do the back of the napkin kind of calculations and write down some numbers and get a thumbs up or a thumbs down. I just sort of look at the combination of hardware and software. And I just get a good gut instinct on whether or not something is technically feasible. That's exactly what happened when my partner at Bleem, David Herpelsheimer, said to me, "What do you think about doing this for the Sega Dreamcast?" I looked at the specs. I thought about it for a little while. And my gut instinct was, yes, this is something that we can do. And that was the same thing with Doom for the Super NES. My gut instinct, before I knew much about the Super FX chipset, was that there was enough horsepower there to make it possible. So I guess I would summarize it by saying optimization came later. The first step for me, and I think that's a common first step, was getting something visual.
Yeah. Do you get, Like, if you see online that someone says, oh, a port to this game wouldn't be possible, does that fire you up a little bit? And you're like, oh, yes. No, it can. Like, I'm wondering if that was the case with the whole Quake GBA prototype that you did. I'm not sure what prompted you to want to do that.
To do it.
Yeah.
I think it was two things. Technical chops, definitely. The challenge accepted.
Yeah.
It was that Game Boy Advance was at the peak of popularity. Doom was a few years behind. Quake was the latest and greatest. And I was familiar with the ARM processor. And so my gut instinct said, yes, you could do Quake. It might be in a lower resolution and it might not have all the features, but you could absolutely do Quake. If you could do Doom on the Super NES, why not? Quake on the Game Boy Advance? Absolutely. Mm. And so I started off rendering a triangle. That's exactly how the Game Boy Advance code for what eventually became Cyboid started off, literally rendering a ultra high resolution. By high resolution, I'm not talking about the number of pixels. I'm talking about sub-pixel, sub-texel for lighting accuracy, using the 32-bit fixed point math of the ARM processor, and a whole bunch of tricks that I was able to use to pull it off.
Hmm. If you could educate gamers on what the hardest thing is about programming, what would you say? And what is the most misunderstood thing about programming?
Wow. Good questions. Because
there's a massive disconnect between gamers and game developers, right? I see a lot of stuff online where gamers say stuff, and I'm like, I'm not an expert, but I'm pretty sure that's not the case. And I feel like that gap hasn't been able to be bridged somewhat. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're in the trenches, and you've been doing it so long, so you must be more aware of it than most.
I think that most of the projects that I've worked on have been projects that people either didn't think about or thought were not possible.
Hmm.
So I haven't had as much experience with somebody looking at one of my projects and saying, this should have been done. If you did this
way, you should have done this
way. You should have done this way. And now that doesn't mean to say that I haven't had people say, my gosh, what an awful, absolute crap. Just total garbage. Yes. No, I mean, critics are everywhere.
Of course. Everyone's got an opinion.
Everyone has at least one opinion.
Yeah. Everyone's a critic.
Everyone is a critic. You sort of learn to set aside what a lot of people say, especially when it comes to saying that something can't be done, or that something should be done in this particular way. A lot of stuff that I've done comes out of nobody having done it yet, which doesn't mean that there isn't somebody else on the planet doing the same kinds of things or working towards the same kinds of goals. Just that at the time, like Dragon's Lair for the Amiga.
Yeah.
I happened to be the first one who did full screen, full color animation with stereo sound streaming from floppy disks on a home computer. I believe that would have come along. I just happened to get there first, and saw a couple of creative ways of using the Amiga's custom chips and hardware to do something that hadn't yet been done. The same, I think, is true of most of the projects that I've done, that it's just been a matter of creatively looking at things. And I think that a lot of non-programmers don't realize how much work goes into something. I guess this goes back to the creativity. There's a lot of creativity involved, but there's a lot of personal pride. There's a lot of me tied up inside the projects that I work on and the programs that I write. And so you have to put on your thick skin when you read a lot of the reviews of your
work,
your blood, sweat, and tears, and your work, because even the simplest things still takes effort. These days, you can just send down thousands and tens of hundreds of thousands of polygons to a GPU, and it rasterizes things for you, and it's like magic. It's amazing. Yeah. Back when I started, you had to write your own rasterizers. So you had to really understand the mathematics behind the graphics and all the work that went into it. And I think that I think the fact that we've come a long way is a good thing, because it means that we get a lot more diverse, creative programs and games, like Stray, for example.
Yeah.
That I don't think would have come about were it not for the ability to use an existing engine and not have to worry about all of the minutiae of calculating, you know, all of the math necessary to do all the rendering.
Yeah.
Does that sort of answer the question?
Yeah, it does. It does. But I think one of the cool things about you specifically, and people from your era, and I suppose in the indie case, because with AAA, I suppose a lot of developers have become quite isolated in their roles, right? Programmer does this, designer does this.
Yes.
Musician does this, but even though that you're a programmer, you still, there was an overlap a little bit.
Yes.
With design and I suppose audio and art. So
art,
you,
definitely.
You yeah,
so
you probably
heard of the term programmer art.
Yeah. So
programmer art, yeah.
Even if you don't know how to do those things specifically, you do have a basic understanding of it. Whereas,
yes,
you know, obviously you're in the trenches and you've got your thing to focus on, but you probably have an understanding of the overall picture. And
yes,
everyone's
absolutely.
Different roles. Yeah.
Yeah. The roles have become quite specialized.
Yes.
Out of necessity. And I think part of that is the disconnect between developers and non-developers, the sheer amount of work and the diversity of talent that it takes to make a AAA game, it's staggering.
Yes. Yeah.
And back 20, 30, 40 years ago, you did it all. I remember for Bubbles, my Centipede clone, I did the graphics, I did the sound, I did the programming. I didn't do the manual. I didn't do the box art, but I did just about everything else.
Hmm.
I think a lot of the projects that I've chosen leverage my strengths as a programmer and minimize my areas of weakness, like art. I'm not a great artist, So if you look at the projects that I've done, they don't really require a lot of art. They don't really require a lot of sound.
Yeah.
And for those that do require art or sound, the art and sound already exist, like Dragon's Lair for the Amiga.
Yeah.
There was a lot of art that was required. So what I did was work with a team of people who touched up the digitized still frames. That's not something that I have the capacity to do. I mean, I could do it if I was pushed to do it, but my strengths lie elsewhere. And so it was better to get artists to do the artwork. And I think the same is true these days, much more so, where you've got multiple different disciplines within art. You've got riggers, you've got background artists, you've got environmental artists, you've got character modelers, you've got, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of specific art disciplines, and that's just art. And then you've got the same for sound, you've got the same for graphics, you've got all sorts of divisions. And I don't mean divisions in a negative way. I mean, you've got all sorts of specialization when it comes to graphics and rendering and technology. And then you've got people who are experts at physics and AI and pathfinding and all sorts of things. And when somebody, I hear people say, oh, it's a $70 game. And $70 is, you know, $70 is $70.
Yeah.
It's not an inconsequential amount of money. But I remember games used to cost $60 to $70. Now that's Canadian, but that's back when Super Mario World came out. And games were $60 or $70 back then. And so I don't think that the cost of games has managed to keep up with inflation. If anything, I think that games are undervalued. A perfect example is Breath of the Wild. I got it on sale, and would have, knowing what I know now about how much time I would spend with the game, I would have paid double or triple what I paid for it.
It's a very interesting conversation to have, because a lot of people argue that because retail has been removed, that the publisher earns more money because there's not as much of a middleman, obviously.
They do
sell a great deal more than they did back in the day, right?
Yes.
I mean, they do. Breath of the Wild is the best-selling Zelda ever, right? I think it's sold like the last three combined. So I think that's the argument. But
I think the argument about physical versus digital absolutely holds water. When you how can I put this succinctly? I cannot figure out why a particular game costs the exact same, be it digital only or physical copy.
Yeah.
That I don't get that. That to me makes no sense. I don't like that. I don't like it. One bit. I think that's probably the copy should have a different price than a digital only.
I think that's
just me.
It's business, I think. I'm trying to make the most money possible, I suppose.
Well, yeah, but it doesn't seem reasonable.
It isn't reasonable. But
I don't know. I'm sure I'm going to anger an awful lot of business execs out there saying, what on earth are you saying?
That's why we're not business execs. Yes, that's exactly it.
That's exactly it. I think that there's something to be said for paying a premium to get it on launch day. If you want it early, if you want it on launch day, I understand, hey, you know what? You should pay a little bit more if you want to get it on launch day. But if you're paying for a digital-only download, why does it cost the same as a physical cartridge now and case? They used to come with manuals. They don't anymore, which I'm not a big fan of that either.
Mm.
But I think there should be a gradation in the cost based on, you know, the actual cost.
Well, games do tend to go down in price usually as time goes on, unless yes. it's a, like, Nintendo pretty much never drops their prices, right?
Yes. So
it doesn't matter if you buy it now or in a year's time or 2 years' time, mm-hmm. it's still going to be the same price. And yes. I suppose that's smart from a business standpoint because they're not devaluing their product.
Right.
They know how yes. much it's worth. Whereas,
yeah, I bought Breath of the Wild years after it came out.
Yeah.
I bought Mario Odyssey years after it came out. And as I said, I would fork over three or four times just based on the fact that it consumed 120 hours compared to other forms of entertainment. I think video games are one of the best values out there.
Definitely
far.
Agree. Yeah. And I know we've talked a little bit about this off air, but like say with movies, right? You don't get yes. the same value for money. If I go to the cinema and then you add up like popcorn and drinks and stuff,
yes,
you've pretty much paid the same, if not more, maybe, than you would have gotten with a video game.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like twice, three times in terms of the amount of entertainment that you're getting.
At least, you can replay the video game.
Yeah.
Whereas when you've watched the movie,
that's it.
That's it. You watch the movie and that's that. I haven't been to many movies recently. And that's probably why I am one of those people that would prefer to wait till it, you know, I can stream it at home.
Streaming, yeah.
Watch it at my leisure. But yeah, I think video games are one of the greatest entertainment value per amount of money spent. And I think that there is a disconnect. The sort of looping back to your prior question, there's a disconnect with how much goes into making AAA titles these days. People expect that because there's Unreal Engine, for example, that every game is going to look like it's made with Unreal Engine and it's made by a large team of people. And I think that those expectations are unrealistic.
Yeah, and the standard has gone up so much, right? That what
yes.
what gamers will tolerate is a lot different to
yes.
the 16-bit era. The expectations way up here. And I mean, you're seeing it a lot with a lot of these layoffs in the industry, right? You know, because they're not making the money that they need to justify the making of like these AAA games that are taking between, 5 to 7 years now?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's an inordinate amount of capital and resources that go into making these AAA titles. And so, I am a little bit surprised at the amount and the breadth of the layoffs from seemingly successful companies. I wonder how much of it has to do with real economics and how much of it has to do with shareholder value.
I think budgets probably has something to do with it as well.
And yes.
Style of management, I feel.
Yes.
Like it's interesting, like when you look at, say, Nintendo, when they were suffering with, say, the Wii U, right? And Iwata and all the execs, they took pay cuts
yes.
in order to avoid laying off any of their staff.
Yes.
Doesn't really work quite like that in the West, right? They'll lay off a whole bunch of staff, and then the CEO gets like a $15 million bonus or something.
Bonus, yes, a bonus, because now there's better profits.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Makes no sense. So different approaches.
Yes.
And maybe that's a model that they should probably reevaluate. Because if you don't have the people in the trenches, then the company's worthless.
Yeah.
The people in the suits can't make the game, right? So...
No. And it is sort of getting back to your other question. It is more and more rare for small teams to be successful because it does take, back when I did, well, even Doom for the Super NES, the graphics were largely done because they were taken from the PC version. The sound effects were largely done, but the music needed a lot of work. The levels needed a lot of work. There was just a lot of people that were involved in making the product, even though it was a port, which isn't to say that a port is less work than an original title. Sometimes a port can be more work than an original title. But a lot of projects that used to be possible with a real small number of people isn't possible. It's, you know, you need multiple artists, multiple people to work on sound, multiple programmers to make something that's at the sort of the minimum bar to entry, based on the expectations. I remember when, you know, games had hideous graphics, but they were spectacular compared to what had come before them. Like, one of my favorite games is Xevious. Okay. It's the top-down shooter.
Yep.
But the graphics made it look 3D because they had done shading on the curved surfaces and the little pyramids and things like that. And the graphics were spectacular for the day. And it was just a 2D scrolling shooter. Those days where that generation over generational leap of graphics or sound or technology, there are fewer and fewer big steps up like that these days.
The increment of increase is smaller and smaller. Like, I can't really notice a big difference between the PS4 and PS5 compared to, say, the PS2 to PS3. That was a massive jump, right?
Absolutely. And you know, to use Breath of the Wild again, it's like the level of graphics and the fidelity and the character animations looked awesome to me, even though it's a Switch, and the Switch is less powerful than a PS5 and less powerful than an Xbox Series S or X, and yet 120 hours later.
Yeah. And I suppose that comes down to graphical art style as well, right? Between, say, stylized versus realistic, because that does play a part.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Final question before I wrap up. Sandy Peterson talked about how he worked on some of the levels of Doom SNES, which is not the case. I think he's getting...
To my recollection, I think he's getting the Super NES version confused with the Jaguar version.
Yeah.
Because...
Which can easily happen.
Yes.
I'm sure when you've worked on a game that was that long ago, details blur.
Yes. So my recollection is that Sandy Peterson may have reviewed the levels, but the actual level editing was minor. It was done at Sculptured Software. We really tried to keep the fidelity of the geometry, the detail of the levels as much. It was for two reasons. One, I had written a tool that basically took a Doom level, and I released it on my GitHub along with all the code for the Super NES version of Doom. So people can see exactly what I had at the time. And it would take a level of Doom and convert it to my engine's formats. But there was no editor. Now, there were public domain editors that were available at the time, and that's what was used to edit the level, but the level edits were minor. We largely left the levels untouched, because A, it was simpler. B, level editing was done, as I said, using a community developed tool that wasn't, you know, apparently nearly as powerful as the one that id Software had, which we didn't have access to. I think Sandy Peterson or somebody at id probably reviewed, because I know that we sent versions to id for approval. But to my knowledge, he wasn't involved in the level editing, the, you know.
So for example, right? So in the Shores of Hell, there's one level E2, M2, which is E2, M3, I think, in the PC version. But because you'd cut out E2, M2, which I think had a secret exit, you had to implement it.
Yes, so we had to add secret exit to another level.
Yeah, so you added in that room, right?
Yes.
Do you remember who added that?
My guess would be that it probably was John Coffey.
Right. Mr. John Coffey.
Yes.
Like the drink, only not spelt the same for Green Mile.
That is correct. John Coffey knew, at least as far as everyone at the office, and Sculpture Software was a fairly large, as far as developers go, not large compared to developers these days.
Yeah, but back in the day, it was pretty large.
Back in the day, it was large developer. And John Coffey knew everything there was to know about Doom. If ever I had a question about how something operates, about any of the levels, about the placement of the objects, John Coffey knew all of it. Absolutely all of it. As a matter of fact, John Coffey once made, at one point, a number of edits to the levels. He had changed the placement of some of the objects and some of the monsters and changed a little bit of the geometry to make it play better on the Super NES version. And we sent it to id Software and said, what do you think of this? And they were having none of it. They said, yeah, absolutely not. We want the levels to be as close to the PC as you possibly can. So,
which I can understand.
That's their area of expertise. And so for that reason, along with all the other ones, we pretty much, one of the changes I know that was made was because of an engine limitation, and that is the metallic grates, where there's areas that are solid and areas that you can see through in one texture. My engine doesn't do that. My engine doesn't have the ability to render textures that have solid opaque areas and also transparent areas. So where those grates were in levels, they were removed. But other than that, the geometry editing was really, really minimal.
Cool. Well, hey, Randy, I will wrap up there. This has been an amazing privilege. Thank you for allocating me your time.
My pleasure.
Time, family time, probably a mixture of
both. Work time and family time, yeah. It was a lot of fun. I'm glad that I was able to answer your questions.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. If anyone wants to keep up to date with what you're doing, is there somewhere where they can go?
They can reach me as at Randall, R-A-N-D-A-L, Linden, L-I-N-D-E-N on Twitter, or they can go to randalllinden.com, and that's a link tree which has links to my social media and stuff like that. I will say as a warning, I don't post a lot.
Probably a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, that is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe, and keep up to date with all the work Randy is working on. Jurassic Park, that's the one that's coming next, is it?
Yes. Yeah. I'm working on the Steam version, as a matter of fact, of Jurassic Park, and get back to it as soon as we hang up here.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Stay safe, everyone. Bye.